The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I am Siobhan Reardon, President and Director here at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And what do you think? Wasn't that a great video? Yeah? As you saw, we're very proud of that here. As you saw, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity at all of our 54 libraries throughout Greater Philadelphia. I'm also proud of the work our talented librarians and staff undertake every day to help transform lives across this city. One of the ways the Free Library has been transforming lives is by helping Philadelphians sign up for health insurance through the Affordable Health App, through the Affordable Health Care Act. Several of our staff members have trained to become certified applications counselors. Actually, over 40 of our staff have done that. At select libraries across the city, people can make an appointment to work with a counselor and sign up for the coverage that's right for them. We're very, very proud to be able to offer this critical service. What's nice about that is these 40 staff members that have taken this training did it of their at their own time and of their own volition, and we're really super proud of the work that they're doing. Thank you. If you value the important work of the library as much as I do, please consider making a donation to the Free Library Foundation. The foundation helps support many of the library's incredible programs like today's author events. And so, as always, you can visit thefreelibrary.org /support to make your gift. It's now my absolute pleasure to introduce Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. Dr. Emanuel is Vice Provost for Global Initiatives and Chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. The author of 9 books on medical ethics and healthcare, Dr. Emanuel writes for the New York Times and previously served as a special advisor for health policy in the Obama administration. In his new book, Reinventing American Healthcare, he explains the American healthcare system, its resistance to reform, and the huge significance of the Affordable Care Act for the future. Dr. Emanuel is also a member of our Healthcare Advisory Council, and we are particularly pleased that he works with us to help improve health information across the city. If Obamacare is to fulfill its promise, there will need to be significant changes that will require collaboration among citizens, healthcare professionals, scholars, and lawmakers from across the political spectrum. And it's the only way this can happen if people understand what exactly is at stake. According to the Boston Globe, Reinventing American Healthcare spells this out clearly, and by doing so lays out the foundation for this kind of collaboration to occur. It is my absolute privilege. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel to the Free Library.
It's a great pleasure to be back at the Free Library and to talk to you. I want to begin with a trip down memory lane, not your family and their history, but to give you an understanding of why and how we got the Affordable Care Act and what it's going to mean for the future. Let's go back to before 2009 and President Obama was inaugurated. We had a very complex, expensive, error-prone healthcare system. On the access side, all of you know that we had 50 million people uninsured in this country. We had 15 million people in the individual market where they often did not get services or their insurance prices in 1 year could be jacked up or they could be denied because they had a pre-existing condition. Or even worse, were something called rescissions, where you paid for insurance and you paid for insurance, and then when you needed it, suddenly insurance company decided you hadn't told us about your back pain or something, and you weren't really covered. We also had a system that was not delivering the best quality care in the United States. There are very many ways of measuring quality of the healthcare system. You may not like like life expectancy and birth, but even life expectancy at 65, we were pretty poor. We were 12th for men and 16th for women. The infection rate in hospitals was pretty substantial. 1 in 20 patients who went into the hospital got an infection, and tens of thousands of people died each year of hospital-acquired infections. We've had medication errors. Not a system we could be proud of. That doesn't mean there aren't pinnacles of greatness in the country, but it's pretty uneven. And then the area I'm most concerned about is the cost of the system. This last year, we spent $2.97 trillion on healthcare, a staggering amount, so much that the American healthcare system is the fifth largest economy in the world. We spend more on healthcare in this country than Britain spends on everything, than France spends on everything, and we're just shy of Germany. It's a huge amount of money, and it's been going up and up and up. In the mid-1960s, we spent 6% of the gross domestic product, 6 cents of every dollar on health care. Today, it's almost 18 cents, a threefold increase over that time. And for many Americans, the amount we're spending on premiums and other things is just a huge proportion of our salary. One of the effects of this very high cost has been on state budgets. Because Medicaid keeps going up, because insurance for state workers keep going up, states have been forced to cut other things in their budget. And the primary target has been education, especially higher education. Tuitions at state universities have been going up dramatically, and a main reason has to do with healthcare costs, because the state has to devote more money to Medicaid and health insurance. It has less money to spend for higher education. And the consequence is tuition for all of us is going up. That doesn't seem like the best investment for the future, cutting education. Similarly, we've had a situation where a big portion of the long-term national debt, of the federal debt, is related to health care costs. And if we don't get health care costs under control, we will have a serious, much more serious national debt problem than we do today. And finally, there are wages. Many people are concerned about the income inequality in the country and the fact that for the last 30 years, wages have been relatively flat, not increasing, and matter of fact, for the last few years, actually decreasing. A large reason for that, not the only reason, but a large reason is increasing healthcare costs that consume an ever larger fraction of the increased productivity of people that cannot be delivered to them in increased cash wages going home. So if you care about any of these issues, the uninsured, the quality of health care, the cost of the health care system, and the effects of that cost on the rest of our lives, you saw a very important reason for reform in 2008. And polls during the election showed that the vast majority of Americans wanted reform of the system. And President Obama had a plan, and John McCain also had a plan, and a large part of the election, not only health care, there was also the sinking economy, the ability to deal with a situation where we were having an implosion, the Great Recession, but health care was one of the top three issues being debated during that election. President Obama came into office, passed the Recovery Act to get the American economy stimulated and working. And then for the next 14 months, we worked on the Affordable Care Act. Some of you may remember, initially, there were lots of overtures to Republicans. These phrases, the gang of six, might come back to you. Senator Max Baucus, who was the head of the Finance Committee, met for months with Republicans on the Finance Committee to try to hammer out a deal. I remember when I was working on it, my boss, Peter Orszag, would go to the Hill and meet with Senator Olympia Snowe, Republican from Maine, and get a list of things she needed in the bill to support the bill. And he would come back and give me and a few colleagues the list, and we had to make sure that those elements were in the bill so that we would have her vote. Despite all the efforts, we could not come to a bipartisan agreement, and this was a bill passed, as you know, by Democratic votes. Although Olympia Snowe did vote for the bill in committee. When it came to the floor of the Senate, she did not. Bill passed almost exactly 4 years ago, March 23rd, 2010. And the bill has been slowly implemented over time. Actually, it'll be completely implemented in 2018 when the last provision goes into effect. We can analyze what the bill does for the healthcare system by looking at three different parts of it. First, on the access part, we have experienced for the last 6 months the major transformation of access. For relatively poor people, it opens up Medicaid for them so that they get coverage through Medicaid. For families that are earning between roughly $30,000 and $90,000, there's the exchange where they get subsidies to buy private insurance. That's been the initial rollout of the federal exchange, a moderate disaster, you might say. The first 2 months, it didn't work. On the first few days, I tried about 100 times to get on to no avail and got the same error message as you did. And then the president brought in Jeff Zients and a tech team to help fix it. The website is working reasonably well now, but it's by no means perfect, and it needs constant attention. After all, the exchanges are an e-commerce site. Basically, what they do is they offer people like you choice of insurance plans at four different levels, and they have insurance companies compete by offering you different arrangements of doctors, hospitals, benefits, different copay arrangements, and allow you to choose. And they're at four different levels of payment and combinations of deductibles. This is a marketplace true to the American system. It's a situation where insurance companies compete and you as a consumer get to choose which option you would prefer most or best. That system is going to roll out. Probably open enrollment ends at the end of this month, and we'll have probably 5 to 5.5 million Americans who will sign up for coverage. That way, through the exchanges, we'll have an additional 7, 8, 9 million people through Medicaid, and then many young people up till age 26 staying on their parents' plan. The important point here is that the exchange provides a very novel and, I think, effective way that allows people to get insurance. Insurance companies are not allowed to discriminate on the basis of pre-existing conditions. They can increase costs for people based on age, but only to a limit of 3 times what a young person pays. The only other factor they can consider in setting the price, besides where you live and what services are available, is smoking history. If you're a smoker, you can be asked to pay more for those benefits. On the quality side, there have been a number of provisions in the bill to increase the quality of American healthcare. Let me give you a few. One thing which I think is a big tragedy, has not got a lot of attention, is something called the Partnership for Patients. Launched in 2010, soon after the bill was passed, this was a concerted effort to attack the problems that happen in hospitals, like the infection rate, like medication errors, like falls and pressure sores. Preliminary results have been nothing short of astounding, and yet almost not disseminated anywhere. So central line infections, that's infections when you put a big needle in here to gain access to the to give drugs and other things, down 50%. Problems associated with ventilators, having a tube in your throat, frequently cause pneumonia, though pneumonias have gone down 50%. Something called early elective delivery, so doctors doing C-sections on women before 39 weeks for no medical problem. Baby's not in trouble, mother's not in trouble. Those have generally been shown not to correlate with good outcomes. There's no reason to do them and not bring a baby to term. Those have gone down more than 50% as a result of this. Pressure sores, ulcers have gone down more than 10%. Huge benefits to improving the quality of care in hospitals. So I think we're all benefited from that bill, whether we know it or not. Similarly, another area in the quality domain has been hospital readmissions. Prior to the passage of the bill, a Medicare patient who was just discharged from the hospital, chance of being readmitted to the hospital within 30 days was up at nearly 20%. Well, there's a penalty in the bill for hospitals that don't reduce that readmission rate and focus their attention on taking care of the patient better once they leave the hospital, connecting them up with their doctor, or having home health aides go to the house. Consequences we've seen since this provision has been enacted, a steady, unremitting decline in the readmission rate. It's not where it should be yet. It's still at around 17.5%, but we have seen a steady drop, and there's every indication it's going to continue. And the last point I'd like to identify in the quality space is electronic health records. Prior to passage of the, actually, Recovery Act, this didn't appear in the Affordable Care Act, prior to passage of the Recovery Act, very few doctors actually used electronic health records or sent their prescriptions in electronically. Now it's at 80%. 80%. Now, I know there are lots of complaints about those electronic health records. They're not the quality we would like them to be. They still don't seamlessly talk to one another. But they're an essential element of the infrastructure of a future healthcare system because communicating electronically, never losing that CT scan, never losing that hospital discharge note, very, very vital. If you move around, say you go to Florida for the summer or you just happen to be traveling and you need your medical record, having it electronically will be good. I want you to remember when people are impatient about the quality of electronic health records. I just want to remind people, you know, we started out with personal computers in the early 1980s, and it was really towards the end of the 1990s when seamlessly you could send an email between an Apple and a PC computer. It'll take time to get this infrastructure perfect, but having all doctors and hospitals electronically linked is going to be really important. And the last place to look is cost control. For the last 3 years, healthcare costs have been relatively flat compared to the growth of the economy, holding down insurance premiums for people. Just to give you an indication, over the last 3 years, Medicare premiums for Part B, that's the outpatient services, and the drug benefits have been pretty much flat, $1 or $2 increases. That's because healthcare inflation in the system has been relatively stable. All of these changes, they're not solidified yet. They're not everything we want them to be, even if we end up with, you know, 10, 13 million more people with health insurance. It doesn't come close to the 50 million people who are uninsured or the 32 million people that the Congressional Budget Office predicts will get insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Even if we have a 50% decline in central line infections or in early deliveries, it's not more. And similarly, on cost control, 2 or 3 years or 4 years is good, but we need to have it for the long term, over a decade, over decades to come. But the Affordable Care Act provides a platform for the future of healthcare. In my book, I outline what I call 6 megatrends for the future, thinking through how is healthcare going to play out. Now, none of this is guaranteed, and making predictions is very risky. One of my colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania studies predictions, and he has warned me about making predictions. He wrote a book about asking over 250 economists to make predictions about the future. They made 28,000 predictions. And one of the things he shows is that experts are barely better than you, intelligent Americans, at making predictions. So with all those caveats, I still make predictions. And why do I make predictions? Because we all have to make predictions about how the future of the system is going to go. If you're a hospital, you have to make predictions of, do you build a new tower? Do you expand and merge with other hospitals? As a doctor, you need to decide, do I affiliate with a hospital? Do I become employed by a hospital? let me rest assured, there ain't no doctor who will be unemployed. If you're an investor, right, lots of venture capitalists out there, where do I put money if I want to invest in healthcare? If you're a drug company, you need to know what's the market for drugs going to look like. Is it going to be better or worse? Is it going to be mostly for generics, or is it going to include new blockbusters? So everyone's making predictions, whether they say they're making predictions or not. So here are, I make six predictions in the book. I'll give you a couple in depth, and then I'll just list the other ones. The first one in the book is that the end of insurance companies as we know them today. Now, yeah, most people are not like real enthusiastic supporters of the health insurance companies, and most politicians know that if they bash them, it's a great applause line. They do some very important things, however, but I think they're going to have to evolve. The way I see it is that we have growing health systems, affiliations of hospitals and doctors, often with nursing facilities or rehabilitation hospitals or home health care agencies. And they come under lots of different names, but the current flavor name is called accountable care organizations. And they get paid often with a bonus for taking care of patients over the continuum of care from the physician's office to the hospital, back to rehabilitation, or just back to home. They are popping up and developing everywhere. Medicare has supported over 200 of them. Private insurance companies have experimented with an additional 200, and they're all across the country. Some are succeeding very well. Some are floundering. But the ones that are succeeding, we're going to figure out the formula. They'll spread to other places. And soon, many of them are going to begin offering and combining their delivery of care with an insurance element. So you're going to not buy independence, but you're going to buy this new health system. They're going to provide all your care. You're going to see the doctors from the health system go to the hospitals. That's already happening. We can see that Long Island Jewish in New York has developed an insurance product and is listing itself on the exchange in New York. It's going to begin contracting, maybe already has, with employers to take their workers and provide coverage for them. In Boston, Partners, that's the Mass General and the Brigham Hospital, they bought an insurance company called Neighborhood, listed on the exchange. And in New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Presbyterian system has directly contracted with Intel to take care of more than 5,000 workers for Intel. You're going to see a rise of this. This is what I would, one way of understanding it is the Kaiserification. So Kaiser is an integrated delivery system out in California, mainly, also in Colorado and Maryland, that provides comprehensive care to people. You are going to see the proliferation of this. I think insurance companies can respond in one of three ways. One way, deny that the change is happening, not adapt to it, and they will become dinosaurs. They are going to disappear, those insurance companies. Second way is that they more or less get out of the health insurance business and they focus on what they do well with data. They help hospitals and doctors and others with big data, analytics, predicting which patients are going to get sick, and other services. And third, those big insurance companies, they're going to begin employing hospitals and doctors, and they're going to become these integrated delivery systems. And again, you already see that beginning to happen. A subdivision of United called Optum has employed 5,000 primary care doctors in 75 markets across the country, believing that primary care doctors are going to be important coordinators of care and really decide how patients are treated. Similarly, WellPoint, second biggest for-profit insurer, has bought a delivery system called CareMore out in California that has the secret sauce for caring for seniors. They have very high quality and their cost structure is about 24% below average. And you have to say, well, why did WellPoint pay $800 million for this group? Well, they want to, again, figure out the secret sauce and bring it to other places. So I think, and I make the prediction in the book, by 2025 we're going to have the end of insurance companies as we know it, and you on the exchange or through your employer are going to choose these integrated delivery systems much more likely than you are going to choose a regular insurance company like you do today. I think that is the direction of the future. Now, that depends upon certain things. Are the exchanges really going to work? Are lots of people going to go into the exchange to buy insurance? And that's a second megatrend I want to talk about. I think that we're going to see a decline in most of us getting insurance through our employer, and most of us going to begin to go to the exchange to get our insurance. So I think there's going to be a decline in employer-sponsored insurance. And let me tell you why. Why does my employer, the University of Pennsylvania, or GE, or a downtown law firm like Saul Ewing, offer insurance? There's no law today that requires employers to offer insurance. That requirement put off to 2015. They offer it because they need to attract good employees, they need to retain good employees, and for me as an individual, going to buy insurance myself, complicated. If I have a pre-existing condition, probably impossible or very, very expensive. And it's easier to become part of a pool of an employer and get insurance, and plus there's a tax advantage. Well, big employers didn't have a way of getting out of that situation and making sure that their employees had an easy way to get insurance without the employer providing it. The exchange provides that easy way of getting insurance going forward. You'll have choice. You'll be able to choose among a number of different offerings, 5 or 6 silver plans, 5 or 6 gold plans, platinum plans. If the employer doesn't provide you a voucher, you can get a subsidy if your income permits. Or your employer may give you a voucher to buy insurance on the exchange and get that tax break. The consequence will be either you'll get a big pay raise and buy insurance on the exchange, or you'll get this voucher from your employer and be able to buy insurance on the exchange. And I believe that many more of us are going to see this once the exchanges become stable, once the choices become good, and the options become desirable. I think that's going to be a good thing. We're going to control which insurance products we have rather than our employer deciding. Most people in America who get employer-based coverage have no choice. They've got one option from their employer, and that's it. And I think in the exchange we'll have more choice of insurer and what we want, these integrated delivery systems going forward, and we'll decide how much of either the voucher or how much we want to spend on health care. And it won't tie us to our employer. We will get insurance separate from our employer and end what many people call job lock, where people continue to work for an employer because they need the insurance, not because they like the work or it's their preferred option. As I say, I make a number of other predictions in the book. Prediction I won't talk about in depth unless you want me to is VIP care for people with chronic illness and mental illness, because this is going to be the key to providing higher quality care and reducing costs. I also make the prediction that we're going to have low healthcare inflation going forward. I think the combination of the exchanges, health systems trying to figure out how to reduce costs by taking care of chronically ill patients better, I think is going to actually bring healthcare costs down towards the end of the decade more permanently. I also make the prediction that we're going to have a rise of digital medicine and a closing of hospitals. Much more of the care that we get is going to be away from a hospital. We're going to have wireless monitoring at home. We're going to be able to send our weight if we have a problem with fluid retention wirelessly through the scale to our doctors that'll monitor. Patients who are diabetic will wirelessly be able to send their blood glucose to the doctor, and a whole variety of other things. We'll have more care, even if we needed hospital care in the past, delivered at home. Hospital at home is a new procedure for actually taking care of sick patients who otherwise would have been admitted to the hospital at home. It's been pioneered here at the Philadelphia VA. Turns out those patients recover faster at home. They get less unnecessary tests. It's cheaper, and they prefer it more. They get more consistently high-quality care. I think we're going to see a proliferation of this because it's better for patients, it's higher quality, and it's less cost. And the consequence is we'll need fewer beds. Philadelphia is one of the cities that's greatly overbedded. We have too many hospitals for our population. Lots of other places in the country do. Vermont, state of 400,000 people, has 11 hospitals. Not really necessary. And so I think this is going to be a big rise of digital medicine, telemedicine, and the consequence being that we will shift where we get our care. And then the last megatrend I predict is a sort of transformation of academic health centers and medical education. We've been teaching doctors essentially the same way for the last 100 years, despite all the changes in healthcare, despite the development of new technologies, despite the increased complexity of the system, we're still following what was published in 1910 called the Flexner Report. We're going to have to change. We're going to change doctors' training so that it's not just doctors. They train in a team with nurses, nutritionists, pharmacists, social workers. So teams take care of patients. We're going to have to change how doctors train because right now, the clinical rotations are almost all in the hospital. The residency programs almost all in the hospital. Well, if what I've said is true, almost all of medicine will move out of the hospital. And it's kind of silly to train doctors in the hospital if most of what they're going to be doing is out of the hospital. And last, there's going to be a lot more management doctors are going to have to do. Managing big data, managing teams, coordinating things. And I think they're going to need much more management skills than we have for them today so that they can optimally provide care to patients. So those are the six big megatrends I see. Are they guaranteed? Absolutely not. Requires decisions by many people in the system. But I think they're the most likely. But I do take my fellow faculty member Phil Tetlock's warning seriously that making predictions is the surest way to be discredited, especially when you write them on paper. Thank you very much, and look forward to your questions.
My name is Joe Dubray. I'm a retired federal employee. And I was very curious about your take, having worked in Washington, because I did too, on why it was the Democrats could not pass a single-payer system. Medicare is a single-payer system. They could have expanded that. Why couldn't they get the votes just among the Democrats?
No chance, no how. It ain't happening. Put it out of your mind. So I think this, there are multiple answers. Let me just give you a few. First, we couldn't even get a public option in the exchanges. There are Democratic senators who do not like single payer. That's the first thing. And so you couldn't have passed it through the Senate. Second, remember, we have a private insurance industry in this country that is, north of $1 trillion. They have an interest in not having a single payer. They have a lot of money, $1 trillion in revenue. Ain't going to happen, right? You got a big interest group that you're not going to happen. And we know that politically because the Clinton plan in 93, what the business guy said, disintermediated the insurance industry, figured out that they would push them to the side, and didn't work. Clinton plan got nowhere. And the last thing I would say, personally, I'm actually not that big a fan of just one way of paying, unless you mean by that that Medicare is going to give people a voucher and they're going to then choose among these private insurance companies. Because one of the problems of having 300 million people in one system is how they decide to pay, how they are organized, becomes very difficult to change. And we need more flexibility now. We're in the midst of a transformation of the system, and one of the key things we need is a lot of experimentation. We don't know the best way to deliver care, for example, to the chronically ill. We don't know the best way to pay doctors, right? We don't know the best way to structure the inpatient hospital experience. We need a lot of experimentation. Having a single payer makes it very hard to change and very hard to have that kind of flexibility. Yeah.
Joe Jackson, associate professor in town. I'm wondering, since the healthcare premiums have stayed low, but the deductibles and the coinsurance has been rising dramatically, is this an unintended consequence of the Affordable Care Act?
The right combination of premiums, deductibles, copays is an important issue. And again, we don't know. For different people, it'll probably be different whether you have a high deductible or and a low premium, or a higher premium with a lower deductible and lower copays. And I think what it is a recognition that for different people, it's there are different advantages to both of those. If you know you're going to use a lot of healthcare services, you might want a lower deductible. You'll pay a higher premium for it. So I think that's, you know, again, it's partly the market responding. A lot of people are going to shop on premium. We know that it's better to shop on the total out-of-pocket expenses that people are going to have. And I believe, actually, again, one of the positive consequences of the Affordable Care Act is we're going to see a number of apps, probably on your smartphone, definitely on the web, that is going to say, all right, about how much healthcare services are you going to use, or did you use last year? What kind of premium do you want to pay? And you're going to put in, and they're going to tell you, you know, this is the premium you should pay. This is the kind of deductible you ought to get to make sure you pay the least for a health insurance plan that's good for you. And so I think we're going to have a lot of support in choosing what we want. But I think that's a consequence of letting the market play.
I can understand why the insurance companies have been lobbying against much of this program. I'm curious, and I haven't seen any summary of how the AMA is reacting to all this. I assume that some doctors love it, some doctors hate it. Is there any kind of consensus in the medical field?
Very good question. So let's talk historically when it came to passage of the passage of the bill. You know, all throughout history, except the earliest days of the 20th century in 1912, when health insurance was first being considered in the United States, the AMA has been against expanding health care coverage, the government expanding health care coverage. So when Truman suggested it in 1948, they were against it. They were not for Medicare and Medicaid, let me remind you. In 1973 and 74, when there was a potential for health care reform under Richard Nixon with Ted Kennedy in the Senate, the AMA was not for it. This time, however, the AMA was for health reform. I have some very important quotes and give you some of the timeline of the AMA supporting health care reform. They had, as you might imagine, some requirements for their support. And the main requirement is they wanted a payment change in how Medicare paid doctors. Interestingly, despite their support, they didn't get that payment change. It goes by the name SGR fix, or the doc fix. It's a situation where if Congress doesn't pass additional money every year, doctors face a potential 24% drop in payments from Medicare. They lobbied hard for that, and it wasn't included in the bill. Ironically, for their support, they didn't get very much. They did not play the political game very wisely in this case. And again, I have a little passage explaining the political dance around malpractice reform and how the AMA did not actually push it as hard as you might have expected. Currently, like many people in America, most doctors don't fully understand the bill. There's a lot of changes. It makes them nervous. And when people get nervous, they tend to be negative. I think, actually, if the reforms play out, doctors are finally going to have the real option of providing care the way they were trained, where they're focusing on really sick patients and they're able to deliver care without focusing on, well, is this billable? Is this something I can get paid for? There's a question in the back there, that woman there.
Thank you. Just following up on what the gentleman in the front had asked about the expanded copay.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as if the people who are in business for themselves who really saw this as a potential help are the ones who are getting the raw end of the deal. They're paying more, finding that the options are less and less for more and more. Is there a chance that this will be fixed within the next couple of years because what was available from the insurance companies ended up being a lot better than what's available online now?
Well, I think actually, you know, you and I may have a different view of what was available to any particular small business and what's available now. The people who benefited from the old system, whether small business or individuals who didn't get employer-based coverage, tended to be relatively well-off and relatively healthy. If you were a small business and you had one employee who was sick, you could forget it. You were not getting good rates, and you had no bargaining power, even if you had 50 or 100 employees. And so when you say we had a better deal under the old, you might have had a better deal in the sense that you had a relatively young workforce, relatively healthy, not a single person had a serious illness. But if one of your workers had, God forbid, contracted cancer, you would have seen a situation where you weren't so happy. And the second thing is, the kind of benefits that were in the packages before were relatively skimpy. This doesn't mean, and let me be frank, that everyone's going to benefit from going to the ACA. Are some people going to see a situation where they will pay more? Yes. Yes, absolutely. Will they get better benefits? And most importantly, will they have a guarantee that that health insurance can never go away? Yes, that's worth something, too. Those, as I said, tend to be relatively well-off people, relatively healthy. The rest of us, and by the way, there are a lot of us, more than half the country, has some chronic illness that usually used to drive up costs. We're going to have a much more stable system, much better benefits, and much more choice options than we would. You've plenty of people who have a situation where they, at the moment, are healthy and at the moment can get a good deal, but they have no guarantee. They, in the old system, would have had no guarantee if they got sick. They would have been able to renew their insurance, or their insurance wouldn't have gone up to an exorbitant level. That's one of the things you have with the exchanges. Yeah.
Could you talk briefly about the mega trend that you mentioned about how the role of behavioral health will play in the managing of chronic health conditions and lowering healthcare costs?
Sure. So I think the second mega trend in the book says that we're going to see a trend towards VIP care for the chronically and mentally ill. And I see this happening in really two waves. The first wave is as healthcare systems try to figure out how they can deliver better quality care for lower costs, they're really going to focus on the chronically ill. So 10% of the population consumes 70% of the healthcare costs. Those 10% tend to be people who have chronic conditions, whether it's heart disease, congestive heart failure, emphysema, diabetes, cancer, asthma. Figuring out how to care for them better, preventing them from having an exacerbation that lands them in the hospital, that's going to be the key to higher quality care and lower cost. And when you look around the country, there are a number of healthcare systems that have really solved that problem. They have figured out the combination of interventions that can keep these people healthier. The diabetic not getting a foot ulcer, or if they get a foot ulcer, not having it so infected that they need an amputation. Or the person with congestive heart failure taking their medications, sticking to a diet low in salt so that they don't get fluid overload and have to go in the hospital. Or if they do get an exacerbation, treating them at home. That's the VIP care for chronic illness. And I think over the next decade, for the next few years, you're going to see healthcare systems all address this problem and try to bring costs down. And when I look around the country, what you end up seeing is around a savings of about 20% of costs. And then once those healthcare systems have really solidly got better management of the chronically ill, you're going to see them look for the next big place where they can improve quality and reduce costs. And that almost uniformly turns out to be mental health. Some of it is mental health services for the really severely mentally disturbed people who have schizophrenia or very severe bipolar disease. But a lot of it is for people who have depression and are functioning in society and are using the healthcare system as a sort of crutch or to keep them socially engaged. We have early experimentation by places that are sort of doing routine screening for depression and dementia and anxiety, and then having interventions. This is in the early stages. I think, again, by the end of the decade, most places are going to have routine screening for these problems and a good immediate, quick way of beginning to address them rather than people now waiting 2 or 3 months for a visit to the psychiatrist. We don't still have the secret sauce on that one, and I think a lot of systems are going to begin experimenting to figure out what combination of, is it a psychologist, a social worker, who needs psychiatric care, who doesn't, for that intervention. There's a gentleman over here.
Thank you, John Mulvihill, University of Oklahoma. Thank you for your leadership.
You came all the way here from Oklahoma?
Where was it you were talking?
Wow.
I have to come.
I'm impressed. I'll be down in Tulsa sometime.
Okay. You use the word we all use, the healthcare system or healthcare non-system. But the real issue is sickness intervention. Most of what you talked about is sickness intervention. And we're all born healthy, basically, apart from a small minority, or we're predisposed. But really, we're healthy, and the business should be health maintenance and not rescue. Is that going to be a mega trend?
That's a really good question. So let me first dispel one of the perceptions about the Affordable Care Act, that it did nothing on prevention. Let me address that by citing three different elements about prevention that played a role. In the Affordable Care Act itself, there are certain prevention elements. One is we have menu labeling in the bill requiring any restaurant or other facility that has more than 20 outlets to have calorie labeling. The regulations, I think, FDA has taken way too long on that, mostly because of concern by the Whole Foods and other groceries that sell pre-made food, not wanting to put that stuff out there. But that is going to be, I think, an important element. Not so much because you and I are going to shop differently, it turns out, but because the manufacturers and the restaurateurs don't want us to know that, you know, that hot chocolate, 550 calories. And they're already, you know, if you've gone to Starbucks, you know that their standard is now 2% milk rather than whole milk and things like that. Second, there's a wellness fund, a prevention fund in the bill that has been used to give grants for cities and towns to facilitate interventions at the sort of public health level. In addition, there is, I always thought that there was, we were, in addition to the Affordable Care Act, working with the First Lady, and I had the pleasure of doing that, on her Let's Move initiative. These were not two distinct activities. They were parallel activities addressing things like obesity in parallel. So I like to view the Let's Move initiative as part of healthcare reform. It's part of a larger picture of the administration to change and to bring in public health measures related to obesity. Now, I don't want to overclaim. It's quite clear that the Let's Move initiative and the First Lady's work has changed the conversation in this country around obesity. It's also, at least early data suggests, beginning to have an effect. The most recent report out of the CDC about the decline in obesity and overweight among 2 to 5-year-olds is very promising. Not a trend yet, one data point, but I think we're beginning to see it's got to be sustained. We need to not let up on the gas. And the last thing I would say is there's provisions in the bill to emphasize employment-based wellness programs, which go along with prevention and trying to keep people healthy. I think all of that together, is it everything you would want on the prevention side? Probably not. But I think it is definitely a much stronger step in that direction than people give the administration credit for.
My name is David Gutman, and you made some predictions, but I'm interested in what's going to happen with dental care. I've got Medicare. I pay for very expensive Blue Cross, and so I don't worry about my medical bills. But I go to your dental school, University of Pennsylvania, in fear every time because it costs so much to get dental care. And I appreciate it because I realize my grandparents didn't have any teeth in their mouth when they were like 45. And I've got most of my teeth, even implants. but it becomes very expensive. So given your experience with getting this, the kind of care you've gotten for ordinary people, how about dental care, which wasn't even discussed for the last 3 or 4 years? It seems to be a big problem for Americans, particularly the same group of people, the ones that didn't have insurance or have children and can't take them regularly for that type of care.
Yeah. No, I'm completely with you. It's actually, when you look at the distribution of where the money in the American healthcare system goes, one of the things that strikes you is maybe we're underinvesting in dental care, and with some of the recent research suggesting that dental care can lead to bad dental care can lead to bad health outcomes. You do begin to worry. Look, the Affordable Care Act barely passed. Some of you may remember the multiple near-death experiences. Can I remind you the name Scott Brown almost brought the whole thing down, okay? There's only so much you can do in a piece of legislation. I say this over and over. No piece of legislation in any democracy in the world is going to be perfect, okay? It just won't. That's the nature of democratic processes. The sausage making they talk about, the horse trading. There's so much that a legislature can deal with at one time. Some things just won't happen. I agree with you. We ought to get more for dental care. There are some provisions in the bill around children and dental care. But that is not everything you and I would want. Nonetheless, is this a very important step forward? Absolutely. And if you had to do it without dental care, or you said, I'm not doing it unless we get dental care, sorry, but yeah, could only do it without dental care, you would take that. The worst thing that we could have done, let me remind you, in 2009 and 2010, the worst thing we could have done, nothing. That's what had happened for 100 years. The most important thing is to make sizable improvement in the right direction. Yeah. This woman's been waiting patiently here.
Carol Ann Kell, and I'm a media consultant here and in Washington. And my question is, having been a sausage maker, and congratulations on getting something. That was what I wanted to preface my question with, because it was really hard, especially with the Republican, the
intransigence, I think is the word.
Thank you. Yeah. Why didn't the Obama administration, with their superior communication skills, not take advantage of the passage and really, so the rollout wasn't so great. Still, there's health care now. There never was. Everybody tried. Everybody failed except Obama. So why didn't they claim credit?
I do think this has been, as I've put it in the book and in other places, a self-inflicted wound. There is no reason that the communication strategy around the Affordable Care Act had to be as bad as it is. And I think even the administration has to recognize it didn't do the best job possible. Let me remind you, however, that lots of things that are unpopular when you do them as a president ultimately become very popular over time. And here, I might take you back to, I think, a president that President Obama eventually will be compared to because of the Affordable Care Act, and that's Harry Truman. Harry Truman today is considered a near great president, just behind the three giants, Washington, Lincoln, and FDR. He's in league with Teddy Roosevelt, Thomas Jefferson. But he wasn't that when he was president, right? In 1948, when he was running for re-election, almost everyone in the country had written him off. He wasn't getting reelected. He was, going to retire in independence. The Chicago Tribune, my hometown paper, predicted on the day of after the election that Dewey had beat him. And Truman took a lot of stands that were unpopular. Might I remind you the integration of the Army, 1948. Not something he said, I wonder what the polling says. Clearly very unpopular. The Marshall Plan had to be called the Marshall Plan, not the Truman Plan. Otherwise, it wasn't going to pass Congress. Right? He wasn't popular. George Marshall was popular. George Marshall announced it at the Harvard graduation. Harry Truman didn't announce it. Not very popular. Now viewed as one of the greatest things America ever did. Right? I think the Affordable Care Act is going to suffer the same fate, which is highly contentious. Once it becomes part of the fabric of the American healthcare system, once all of us become used to getting our insurance in the exchange, once we see that it keeps healthcare costs down and improves the quality of care for people who have chronic illness and mental illness, I think in a decade we're going to have a very different view. We're going to say, you know, this is a miracle, and it's really done a remarkable job for the country, and we're going to scratch our heads by, how did it ever happen? We're going to try to figure out, how did it actually happen that he got it passed when for 100 years it had been, you know, defeated over and over again? And I think, you know, in that light, we're going to see, you know, this was highly unlikely to happen, a very important thing for the country, and all of us are going to be, I think today we're better off for it, and we're going to increasingly become better off for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.